Blog Talk Radio.
Time to check your equipment. Shoulder pad?
Check.
Spike shoes?
Check.
Poison for spike?
Check.
Switchblade knives?
Check.
Brass knuckles?
Check.
Hand grenade?
Check.
Then we're ready.
After 10 long years, this is Return to Werewolf, and I am your host, Dr. Brett, and tonight's show is going to be an interview with Lynn Lockhart. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I am at home with my family, and so they're just handling something.
So we have,
it's all done now. But
we have the we're going to have some input from your family.
Yeah, there might
throughout
be
the
just
show,
like in the old crackpot days. Yeah.
Yeah, the old podcast with Mr. LaFawn. So it's an honor to have you on the show, Lynn. This is our inaugural broadcast on Return to Werewolf, and I've been wanting to interview you for about a year now because I've been just very impressed with your work for James, Mr. LaFond, over the course of the past few years, and your willingness to work on that and to volunteer your time and effort and skills to aid his work, and which I just think is very noble, as well as appreciation for the arts, as it were. And it's quite an endeavor for, as you know, as we heard in the beginning of the show, that you're a mother of several children, small children, even, so it's not as if you have nothing better to do. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I wanted to begin. I don't remember what year I began reading James's website. And that's jameslafawn.com, I believe. And
right.
I know it was before the Baltimore riots and in 2015. So what year did you come on? What year did you join and begin editing and, you know, basically doing his being his editor and curator of his works?
Yeah, it was exactly the year. It was the Baltimore riots. I used to lurk on MPC, which I understand is now entirely defunct. I think I saw on your timeline you said that you were trying to get your money back because they closed down. What happened to MPC?
I had to. I don't want to get off topic there, but I'm making jokes about, you know, I gave $20 as the tax, and then. You know, unfortunately, the gentleman who ran MPC was outed to his work.
Oh.
And consequently, I'm not sure if his wife left him or not, but either way, it was kind of unfortunate. So I looked her up on Facebook the other day, and I noticed she cut her hair, which is usually a sign that a woman's going through a divorce or a breakup.
Could be.
And so nonetheless, I sent her a message and asked her if she could arrange with him to give me my money back. But I'm not serious about any of it. That's, you know, I'm just fooling around. I got my money's worth. But nonetheless, so you started on MPC.
I enjoyed.
Is that where you?
Yeah, I don't know how I found MPC, but I was on MPC and I the Freddie Gray thing was going on in April of 2015, and somebody there put a quote from LaFond, and I had to click over and read more, and then I slowly got sucked in more and more to the various genres that he writes in, which is a multitude, as you know.
Yeah.
And then I decided to email him for, I think I wanted to share a news story or something. He ignored me for a long time. And then I emailed him more, and he finally like clicked in that it would be interesting, I guess, to email with me. And then in around 2017, early part of 2017, when he was like, hey, you know, I could use some help, like just organizing, like I need a list of books that I've written and published. So like, that's a, you know, I would never expect, you know, that would be a huge job in itself to just make a list of how many books one person has written. And so in doing that project and creating a spreadsheet for it, I, you know, I became even more amazed at how much writing, how many topics. And the more I read, I thought, you know, this is really unique, really, there's somebody like him writing, and nobody has heard of this guy. And besides that, these books, to be honest, you know, they're self-published, and there's certain people who will read a book like that and they will just throw it away because it's got typos or the formatting is weird or something, you know. And then I thought to myself, well, maybe those people don't deserve to read this. You know, if you can't get past a misspelled word, then maybe you don't deserve to like achieve this esoteric knowledge. So I kind of debated that. And then after a while, I just thought, you know, this work deserves to look nice, look like real book. And so then I began, at some point I said, you know, I'm not going to let you publish books anymore. I'm going to edit them. And he agreed to that, although he's since circumvented that rule by publishing drafts.
He sent me about 15 drafts earlier this month, which I haven't even been able to start to read.
No, he writes more than any normal person can read. That's, if you think about that, it's kind of staggering. One guy,
It's really extraordinary, and, you know, especially when you see a lot of writers complaining about writer's block and all these things, and the honest truth is they just don't want to find anything to write about, and they just don't view it as a work, you know, and that's
right.
Really right. Always surprised me with James, is his ability to do that and your ability to keep up with him.
I try. I feel good if I can put out, you know, like – one book for every four that he submits in draft, and I can edit and publish. It depends. I mean, some of the fiction books are quite short, and those are not a lot of work. But the history books, particularly Cracker Boy, is just a massive, massive work, and that one took a lot out of me. You know, so book for book, they're not equal, but
absolutely,
yeah, but I've learned a lot doing it. I've learned a lot about the history of America, and I've gained technical skills of, you know, book publishing and podcasting and stuff like that. So it's definitely is a hobby for me, and you know, I just see it as a contribution to, I really think it's good if a person can read his work and accept it and understand it, then, you know, that's a good thing to me. So
absolutely.
That's why I do it.
And you touched on something else there. You were also the producer when he was doing podcasts, and you produced any number of shows, and I've had to multiple people have made them listen to your intro to the podcast with the one of your children, I assume, introing the podcast and then the Towns Van Zandt song in the background.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a really awesome intro.
Oh, thanks.
It seems quite spontaneous.
You know, when I first started, I have only two children. I feel like that's not enough for really trad mom credibility, you know, but when I first was podcasting in my arms, you know, and the older one was running around, she's very active. And so it's like, what are you doing, mom? So I just would explain, well, this is the microphone. And I showed her and I recorded them, you know, giggling, laughing and screaming or singing songs. And then I would play the recording back. And then that kind of demystifies it for the kid, you know? So it was my way of explaining what I was doing and including her in it so that she would give me more latitude to be able to do it, you know? But
yeah,
it was
absolutely cute.
And, you know, it's like, I guess when you're trying to brand something, you just go with it, stick with it. So it's cute, still there. Yeah.
Absolutely. And James said for a while there, I believe, that he didn't want to do any more podcasts, but hopefully the status is really on hiatus. We'll see some more in the future, because I've noticed that you were kind of like the Eben Britton is on Mike Tyson's podcast, in that not only did you produce it, but you were able to keep the flow going well of the conversation when you had guests and so forth.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I appreciate that. It was really fun to do. It turned into a lot of work because I like to listen back to it and edit, and it just turned into more work than what I can really handle. And especially it was the beginning of Corona times, and it was like, just can't do it anymore. We need to take a break. So I do think of it as a break. Nobody knows what the future holds. So maybe one day we'll pick it up again. But it was super fun to do. And I love the guests. I mean, we had this rule where we would not speak to anyone who was actually famous. Everyone had to be less famous than James. And then, you know, we talked to people who are actual working class people. And I just have to laugh because you have all these podcasts who are making real money, and they are like leftist podcasts who are really concerned with these kind of Marxist ideas about the working class and stuff. I'm like, I have podcasts with actual working class people, truck drivers and oil rig workers and barber, you know, it's like grocery store, you know.
Yeah. I like those podcasts with John Paul Barber particularly. He has a very unique accent, a regional accent that's starting to die out, and he was good. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. And you know, in a different situation, that would have definitely made money. But, you know, obviously, even on the right, a lot of these podcasts don't want to deal with average people, you know.
Right. Oh, no, definitely. But, absolutely. But I laughed at myself. I looked at these podcasts that are making a lot of money, and I think, well, I can see. I understand what they're doing differently than what we're doing, and that's okay. That's not what I want to do. You know, someday if I have to put food on the table and do a podcast behind a paywall, and we'll see if we ever have to cross that bridge. It's something I thought about because it was a lot of work. It was a lot of joy. But, you know, at some point I thought, there's people out there, you know, Red Scare and all these, the Brunigs, these people make real money doing this. So it would be nice to make money. So, you know, I like that we kept it as just a hobby and something that's free and that's out there forever. You can go back and listen to all the old episodes. It's nice.
Yeah, and I do. Yeah, I drive around a lot, so I listen to a lot of the episodes while I'm driving around. And sometimes re-listen to them. But,
yeah,
I would say that certainly if you ever wanted to do a pay podcast, I would certainly consider it worth paying for. You want to do
a
producer,
well, I appreciate
whatever.
Yeah.
But in so far as James' works go, Mr. LaFon's works, do you find some easier to edit? We were just talking about that a little bit. You're saying the histories are kind of more work because they're more dense, certainly, you know. So, you know, and you probably had the best grasp having written or read the most of it the most times. So,
right.
You know, some of us have read it one or two or three times at the most. How many times you've probably gone through it? You probably have them committed to memory, some of them anyway.
Some of it, yeah. It comes back and you're like, is this in a different book or did I already read this? When I edit the fiction, all I'm basically trying to do is clean up any kind of typos or misspellings and then make sure that the reader can follow the action. Because there's usually people getting stabbed and, you know, dismembered or killed or whatever. So I just want part of it to be clear, like who's getting stabbed by who and stuff like that. And but in the history, I want to make sure that the quotes are correct and that they're correctly referenced. And I just want to be really careful about the factual statements and just, you know, fact check as much as I can. Where did this come from? And is it really fair to say this? And then they are dense. I mean, he includes a big chunks of the primary sources, which I think is why the books are so impactful, because he's not just saying like, oh, this and such happened, and then you have to go to a footnote, and that footnote sends you to some other book, and then you have to look for that page. You know, it's right there. Like, Cracker Boy has dozens and dozens of runaway slave ads printed verbatim as they appeared in newspapers. I think those are like from the late 1700s, if I recall correctly. You know, it's right there. It's right there. And it does. And it also gives you the source of where to look. So the Plantation America stuff, I think it's really tough on people because we still, you know, most of us, especially in the right wing, still hang on to like these, the mythology of American history that we're taught in schools. And it's like you're a fish swimming in water, you know, when you step back and say, wait a minute, you know, what we are taught is actually a mythology. It's not a history.
It's an illusion.
Right.
To say the least.
There's
a lot of information, and you know, if you did it any other way, people would say TLDR, and then they would quarrel with the sources and say, well, we didn't read it, but it's wrong, you know. So block quotes are necessary in a lot of ways, you know, as you bring out that you have to put all that information right there on the page. Otherwise, it's not going to be taken seriously, you know.
Right. And this is from a guy who dropped out of high school and certainly never went to university or was trained as a historian, you know, and I think that's so important because more and more, you know, as we kind of go through this process of like uncovering the truth all around us, and we see that a university education is 90% of the time just a reinforcement of the mythology that is required to keep the system functioning. You know, I have dear friends who are history majors And it's like, what are history majors allowed to study? They're allowed to study about how Hitler was bad, and they're allowed to study about women's roles in various eras of history. You know, you're allowed to study about, I mean, it's just, you take your pick, right?
The curriculums and the reading lists are kind of a joke because that's what you have. I've always thought of James as in the Louis L'Amour tradition, and Louis L'Amour said you shouldn't not go to school unless you read 100 books a month, which I know James probably did many times. And the thing about as you were saying, is a lot of these history majors, and they have a prescribed reading list that they have to read, and they don't deviate from that to any extent. So they don't read any sources outside what they're told to read to make their grade. So, you know, I talk about various authors to people, and they may have heard of Thomas Carlyle, and usually they've read his book, Retailored, for example. And but they haven't read the Latter Day pamphlets or stuff like that. But anyway, it's touching on the subject of education. On top of you being an editor and producer and stay at home mom, you're also homeschooling your kids.
Yes, yeah. In the era of Corona times, my kids are elementary school age, and it's so funny because, you know, the stereotype is that homeschoolers are unsocialized, and I don't care what people say, but, you know, the one thing is actually as a mom, as a homeschooling mom, I need to socialize. I need other moms and parents and families to hang out with and talk to. And, you know, we never get out of the house, blah, blah, blah. Well, Corona times really goes to show how wrong that was, you know, and locked my poor family in the house. I mean, last summer, we like to go to the beach. We're in California. We go to the beach every week. Last summer, I was with my two little kids dodging police at the beach, you know, at parks dodging police. It's like, what kind of a bizarre world do we live in where a mom and two little kids is like the criminal, you know, that has to keep her eye out for the fuzz at all times. And we did, you know, we like were scurried out of parks by cops a couple times. I never got in trouble, but it was really aggravating to me. But I always knew that I would not be able to put my kids in public school. And then as the time grew closer, I realized that private school is not what I want either. And homeschooling definitely has its pitfalls. It's not easy. It's you give up all the economies of scale, which is a good thing, you know, overall, but it is more work for the family because you're sort of recreating the wheel on these things. But I love spending time with my children. I like them, you know, and I'm enjoying going through the process where, you know, we do phonics. We're doing all kinds of arithmetic. We follow a structure. I have curriculum that we work through methodically. Other families are more, or less structured. Other families are more structured. But I feel very good about not answering to anyone about what my kids know and how they know it. Like, I get so frustrated when I talk to people about the math curriculum. Like, it's in private schools as well as public schools, and it's extremely common for, you know, these Silicon Valley families, high achievers, to put their kids in after-school math programs, Russian School of Math or Mathnasium or these shops where you go and the kids just drill, because all the school time devoted to math is completely wasted on Common Core garbage. And it's like, you're in private school, you're paying for private school, you have to, on top of that, pay for some math supplementation, and you're wasting twice as much time, you know, to get this confidence into your kids. It's just bad deal all around.
Full disclosure, I was homeschooled as well, so I know it's very stressful, particularly on the mother, and it's better if you like your kids than your kids like you, because that was not the case in my family. But nonetheless, I'm well aware and empathetic to the mother's role, because they bear the brunt of the whole job, basically. It's very strenuous,
because
you're
extra
going
work.
Probably 12 hours a day, I would estimate, you know, so. Do you read to your children aloud?
Oh, yeah. I read aloud, and the one piece of technology I'm extremely grateful for is streaming books from the library.
Yeah,
we use Hoopla, and Hoopla has a lot of classics. They have all the Narnia books and the Lord of the Rings, the Tolkien. We've listened to The Hobbit, you know, dozens and dozens of times, and they like the Boxcar Children books. We listen to Mary Poppins books, and they like to hear the same thing over and over, is something that's true of many children. So that saves me some effort, but I do read aloud myself to them as well every day. Yeah.
You know, I think it's kind of sad that a lot of children won't have the fortune to experience that what you're giving your children. There's a lot of old children's books, and I discussed this with James. He was working on that particular book about a girl and her dog that they can communicate, I believe, telepathically or something like that.
Yeah.
But I haven't read it yet, but it's on my queued up. But in any case, I just in general, the number of children today are deprived of a lot. You mentioned the Boxcar Kids, and going back to that time, the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and all those series, the We Were There series, historical series, which is an awesome series for kids, and just kids today won't have any of that. And it's starting to become critical, because I think a lot of kids today have anxiety orders because they don't have any heroes or role models introduced to them in their early years that might otherwise sustain them in difficult times.
Oh, that's a great point. I didn't think of that. I think it's hugely valuable to seed their imagination. Yeah, and that includes role models and pictures of places they've never been, word pictures of places they've never been. My kids play pretend hours and hours each day. They have these incredibly complex and long running games. We watch some videos. We're not like a zero TV family, but it's once a week, maybe a short video on DVD. So they have a lot of imagination. I think, it's just something to give them. It's a gift. I don't know that it's any deeper than that. I cannot guarantee that they're going to have, you know, much better lives than the average kid. I hope that they will. But as a parent, I have realized that I absolutely can't guarantee that. So I'm just doing the best that I can for them. Like, I think about something like ballet. We're not lessons, but I think, well, should we be in ballet lessons? You know, that's like this luxury, totally bougie thing, you know, that my family growing up, we didn't have any extra money, you know, as an understatement. But, you know, so it's like, well, we could afford ballet lessons, and maybe they would like that. But you have to realize that it's just simply a gift for right now. It's something that they may hold somehow, or music, I think, is more valuable. And we do some music lessons from a family member, although that's on hold because of Corona times. But, you know, all these things that you do for kids, from my point of view, it's simply a gift. It's not a guarantee that they will, you know, grow up to be happy or well-adjusted or healthy. Like, you hope that all these things for your kids, but I have to be realistic about it. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Well,
but
you're giving them a solid basis, though, with your effort.
Yeah.
A solid basis in the English language and being able to write and speak and think about it. And and think about things in general with the advantage of using their imagination and using those muscles of their mentality. So I would certainly think that would be giving them a massive advantage in general.
So I hope
not
so.
All homeschoolers obviously turn out to be world beaters, but they generally turn out to be solid citizens, you know? So
yeah. Right. And that's something that is tricky because people are so outcome oriented. Like, are they going to get into Ivy League schools? Well, I have no idea. I don't really want them to, you know, but especially here in Silicon Valley, it's like, you know, I want results. I want a guarantee that my kids will be earning big bucks and achieving and doing this stuff. And I just think, We're just doing our best, you know. We don't know what the future holds for them or for the wider world. So we're trying to make the best of our time right now, and hopefully we'll give them the tools that they need for the future as well.
Absolutely. And you have, just in general, in becoming an editor, and I want to talk little bit about that in a minute, but you have a wider, more broad perspective on a lot of things, because like a lot of people who might have encountered MPC, and I believe you mentioned on Twitter a long time ago how you found MPC, and I don't remember what you said, and
I'm not
100% sure. I'm not 100% sure you even did mention anything about it, but it just vaguely. So what I'm saying is you had a very open mind to, and I've always been very impressed about how open and creative your mind is to just find MPC in the first place and appreciate it as an art form. And then to go from that to finding James and appreciating James's art, because James has almost got a fairly unique art niche. And it's kind of a dying era, because I have a understanding of it going back to the Paladin days of the, which was his initial publisher. And there were a lot of kind of working men authors back in the day in the 70s, but there aren't any today because it doesn't really pay to sit down and write all day. So I've been impressed with your open-mindedness. And how did you kind of develop that over time? How did you come to, you went through the education system in the United States, obviously, but you had a broader understanding or willingness to try to learn things than the average person.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. My family comes from another country. I was born here. My parents spoke only Spanish when I was born. I went to kindergarten and I didn't speak English. I understood most of what people told me, but I was unable to make myself understood at that time. I think by first grade, my English was pretty good. Although I don't have like super crystal clear memories of that, all that stuff, but I went to public schools in California. I went to pretty decent ones, pretty lucky, I guess. Went to college. I just, you know, I did like the very sort of basic path that you're supposed to do, you know, go to school, get good grades, go to college. I met my husband in college. We got married after we graduated and both had jobs. And a few years later, we had kids, and it's like a pretty generic story, I guess. In terms of, like, my general curiosity, I think it's just something that I was born with. I liked school. I didn't necessarily enjoy school, but I liked learning and getting good grades and stuff. You know, like being a rule follower. So in the surface, I'm a conformist person because I just do my job and meet my responsibilities and stuff. But in my mind, I guess I rejected certain things that were presented to me. Today, I was in this little Twitter fight with a college professor, and I was recalling that when I was in college, I had a friend who he took the exam to go to the Army, and he didn't do well enough to be accepted to the military. But that did not prevent the local private college from accepting him and taking his money. And then when he dropped out in a year, he still owed the money, of course. And I remember just thinking how unethical it was of that college to accept him when it was obvious that he was not going to succeed in college. And so that was, you know, 20 plus years ago when I was a college student. And so I was like red-pilled on college when I was in college. And I was stunned today that, a college professor, that he was stunned about the student loan debt bubble that is, you know, $1 billion plus and whatever. I still have an affinity for the truth, even if the truth is unpleasant. And I think that that's a lot of what LaFond writes and what he was writing in the Freddie Gray days is like, here's what it's like for a guy who's just walking and on the bus and working in a town that is in some kind of a low-level war, civil war situation, and not what the media describes. And then the more I read from LaFond, the more I realized that he's a person who really ruthlessly looks for the truth. You know, I mean, no matter how unpleasant. And as someone who was, as an immigrant child who was brought up to love America, and I still do, it's still, you know, it's my country. But that's a painful realization to look at the Constitution and say, okay, yeah, that it really is just a piece of paper and it is actually torn up and flushed down the toilet decades ago. if not more than that.
You're a good noticer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That might be one of your superpowers.
Thank you.
But I mean,
and I noticed that people don't want to notice. Lots of people don't, and that, you know, that's their choice. That's okay.
Well, I witnessed the whole connection you had with James because I remember he would publish your letters to him sometimes on his website, and I'd read them. And 2015, I believe it was not a great year for me, so I was on the road a lot, and I read his site when I could, you know. But I remember your letters to him. And that, you know, you were getting involved in that process of editing and so on. And so it just was unusual that someone like yourself would be involved in that, be an anomaly. And so I thought it was even more extraordinary that that was the case. And so regarding that, the next question. It slipped my
mind. Yeah, the mismatch. People like the mismatch between. Is that what you mean? Like the between me and James? Is that I'm a woman. Yeah. Even just being a woman is unusual. Like, I remember NPC just had one or two girls ever posting on there, and who knows how many were lurking. I never posted, but, so being a woman I felt like it was entertaining. I didn't have to, I was just lurking and freeloading off the entertainment, but, yeah, I mean, and you know, the first few emails, he couldn't tell I was a woman. I think that's why he ignored me. And then he figured out I was a woman. And it was like more interest, you know. But, yeah, the mismatch is fun, you know, because I am like this solidly middle-class woman, soccer mom, whatever, you know, kind of image. And he's lifelong grocer. And total knucklehead, likes to beat people and stuff like that. So the contrast is fun. And but what we have in common is that we prefer the truth on all these various topics that are interesting and maybe even useful for grappling with the future that we face, where we're in like this end of empire age, where our country is decadent and toppling or teetering, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not, maybe it's got 100 years left in it, but it feels like things are on the cusp of changing, and how to mentally prepare yourself for that and try to prepare your family and loved ones somehow for that as
well. Well, I feel like, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I feel like you have the curiosity in that end of it, but you also have a fair amount of vitality, which probably comes from the immigrant part partially, because you find Americans being tired all the time, and I'm sure you're tired as well, but just the whole roles, I don't think people appreciate how much time and effort you put into the curation and editing of James's works, not to mention the production of the podcast. It takes a lot of vitality to fuel the curiosity or the quest for truth, as it were. And I've always been impressed by that.
Yeah.
You know, Bronze Age Pervert, who is also from the, what we might say, the European diaspora. And I kind of connected him with you, because it took a good 10 years. I've known Bronze Age Pervert for like 15 years now. And when he came, when he started, he was an anti-communist, you know, and he had a very neocon perspective. And it took 10 years of Thomas 777 just relentlessly beating him up every day in discussions to crystallize the views he's putting out now. So you didn't go through that process, but he has a certain vitality that he pushes out there, and you have a certain vitality, whether it's posting on Twitter or, you know, I know a lot of times your voice on the podcast, you're tired, you have the kids, you're working with James, and you don't sound fresh, certainly, in some of them, but you're not, you're always pushing forward, you know, you're engaging it, and you don't sound bad, it's just not, you're in the midst of it, as it were, you know.
Yeah.
In the midst of the fray.
Yeah, I remember.
And
some days it was definitely. I felt like if it was late at night, I felt like I am completely tapped out. I have no intellectual reserves. I'm just like limping along. But you know, I figure people can listen or not listen. It's okay. But
well,
yeah.
And you kept it.
Vitality
you
and
kept
energy.
It going. It's,
yeah.
So I think that's certainly part of it, and that's I kind of just connect you two together with him because you both have a different kind
it's
of
high
energy,
praise.
One might say, than the typical American of the generational stock, because usually they have a habit of just deteriorating at a more rapid pace, and I have both, you know, I have a very heritage American background, and so I kind of observe both types, you know, as it were. So,
well, I appreciate what you're saying. I think that when we talk about stuff like the forests or, you know, the immigrant flows that we see, which has to do with reducing the cost of labor for sure, and I would say that that's the majority of it, but part of it is also, I think, because of what you say, because heritage Americans may or may not choose to just work really hard all the time. I remember that one of my close friends in school growing up, her mom noticed that myself and my three siblings would always get really good grades. And her mom said, well, you know, my daughter doesn't do that because she knows she'll be fine. She's American and she knows that she'll have a job and stuff, but your kids are really nervous and worried about stuff. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but this is almost exactly what she told my mom. And I was like 11, you know, and just really energetic. And all my siblings, like, we're just working like somebody's chasing us, you know, and this is still true. We're all really high achievers and hard workers. And there is a hunger that immigrants tend to have that Americans don't always have. And it has to do with prosperity, like generations of prosperity, I think, and security. And even people who are not prosperous by American standards are still extremely comfortable. And you know, I don't know what it is, but like I do, it's like I have something facing me. I still feel that. And I'm not making money, although I am starting to list books on my own account. So I might make a few bucks this year on LaFon's writing. And he has very kindly indicated that the books that I publish will belong to me when he dies. So maybe this will turn into money someday. But I do, I have a drive to work and my brothers have it. And I do feel like we have it more than average of our peers, of our American peers.
My belief is that the American system is fundamentally vampiric, and that's why they have to keep appointing immigrants because it leaches the spirit and soul and energy out of people as they migrate into the United States. But so, yes, generations will come hungry and motivated and so on, and within a few generations, they won't deteriorate necessarily. They say, oh, the next generation's gone to the dogs. It's not so much that as it gets everything gets leached out of them by the American way of life.
That's a good way.
In my opinion.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, it kind of reduces everything to a commodity. It commodifies everything, monetizes everything, and it does. It just kind of drains the vitality out of people. That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah.
Now, there are two individuals. I believe anybody writing a history of these circles in the future would list as having a prominent role in the literature of today in these circles, as I said, and that would be yourself and Anne Sturzinger. And Anne's edited all my books that have been published anyway, and some that haven't. And she's also a writer. So have you thought of writing a book yourself?
I have thought about it. I have some ideas. And we talked earlier about like the writer's block thing. And so what it would take for me is to really prioritize my own writing. And I have never, ever done that. It's not a super high priority for me. And thank you, by the way, you are giving me very high praise by associating me with these other names, including Anne. And I know that Anne is a writer in her own right. And I just think that's fantastic. And I think it takes a little extra something that I am not sure I have, and I am kind of private. I know that doesn't really square with the fact that I have a podcast and shared about myself, but I do, I feel a little bit like writing things that I have written. Some stuff is like in locked Word files on my desktop. I don't ever want anybody to read, you know, so it takes some ability to expose yourself. I mean, I look at the people it takes. Yeah. And I don't know if I have that. And in addition to prioritizing the time and energy and effort of my own writing, although it's lurking in there, it still takes a lot. Like I don't put pictures of myself online, and that's partly because I don't want to be doxxed and all that. And it's partly because it's like there is a level of privacy that a lot of people don't have. A lot of people put everything out there. But I, you know, there's a lot that I don't put out there. So both of those would be something to grapple with. But I appreciate the sentiment. I really love doing what I do for James. I think that he has enough talent by himself to keep me busy trying to reach more people and to, you know, polish it up so that it's good for posterity and stuff like that. So for right now, I would say don't look for anything written by me. I've actually thought about like writing something under another pseudonym. to add more anonymity.
Well,
but we'll see.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, but you know, it's certainly something to think of for, I'm sure, you know, but again,
yeah.
Not to diminish your role as an editor, because I don't think people appreciate, and being a published author myself, I really appreciate particularly how important the role of the editor is. Because it's just very important. And for example, when I was had my first book written, you know, I was going to take it to a mainstream editor. I couldn't do that. You know, I knew they were going to change too much. You know. My first editor was actually Chip Smith, who's on Twitter, and he has 9 Banded Books, and he put out my first book, but. Chip is a brilliant editor. He leaves my he left my stuff alone, and well, actually, Ann edited that one too, but Chip published it. But anyway, Chip is a really good editor. Ann's a good editor, and people don't appreciate it. You can't really have a book. It's like a music album. You can't have a music album without a producer.
Right.
I guess, but it's not going to turn out worth listening to or worth reading. And so one can't. Appreciate enough the role of the editor. And, you know, in the final minutes of the broadcast, like I said, I did want to pay tribute to you for that and your willingness to continue and tackle these ongoing projects and these increasing projects, because I know James feels like he's trying to get all this material out of him and try to produce all this work. In his declining years, as he puts it. But I truly believe, for example, as you know, I post a lot of anti-women things on Twitter, and I enjoy that. And it takes a genuine misogynist, not just an internet misogynist, somebody who truly hates women to pay tribute to women.
Well,
and
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you please.
No,
I
James has a very very good view on women in general, but I think in order to truly appreciate a woman, you have to hate the vast majority of them, you know, because then you have a heartfelt appreciation for a woman who's successful in her field and good at what she does.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, and again for putting me in that bucket. You know, I have to say that most internet misogyny rolls right off my back. even real life misogyny rolls right off my back. I just honestly don't care. I don't know how else to say it. Like, I just don't care, you know. I think a lot of misogyny is maybe like a defense mechanism to keep people, you know, keep crazy women away or keep unpleasant women away. And sometimes
it's mostly
keep
the
me
result
away.
Of trauma. For
result
most
of
men,
trauma. And
I
don't
say.
Discount. Yeah, I don't discount that at all. I think, you know, these, yeah, you've suffered in different ways and that's a natural response. So for the most part, I ignore it. And if it's something that does kind of get to me for whatever reason, then, you know, I will just ignore it more because I don't like that feeling. But, you know, it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem that men and women, we have lost the framework to be able to interact in positive ways. I guess it's like a short way of saying it because, you know, I'm not like a white Sharia kind of person. I think men and women can have relationships that are appropriate and have bounds and have that good things can come out of them. And as a woman, I like participating in public life to the extent that I do. But yeah, it's a problem. You know, there's a lot of crazy women out there. There's men that have problems and a lot of pain in between the sexes. And I don't like that. But it's one of those things I can't really do anything about. You have to know your limitations.
I think the both sexes need to dance more with each other. I think dancing is the key to realignment of their
relationship. Perfect analogy. Yeah, because dancing is a framework, and you know you enter this framework and you each play your role, and then that's a pleasurable interaction with boundaries and expectations and stuff. Like, I think that's a great idea. I like it.
Well, anyway, we're coming to the wrap-up of this broadcast. It's been an honor to talk to you today, Lynn, and to do some more broadcasts with you in the future on different subjects. Barb's wife put out a book, The Secret of the She-Bear, and I don't know if you've read it yet. And
no.
She just had her seventh child as well, so she's quite an extraordinary woman as well, like you. And it's a very interesting book, a very dense book. It's very similar to James's books, but sometime in the future, perhaps I'd like to discuss that and maybe some other things as well. Have a future broadcast if you're available.
Yeah.
And do you have any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
My closing thoughts. Well, it's an honor that you thought of me and that you speak highly of me. I appreciate it incredibly. I remember when you and Richard Stark, Richard Stark got kicked off in the big purge. But I remember when you guys
Robert Stark.
James on Robert Stark.
Yeah,
sorry.
I hectored him.
Yeah. And so, I definitely want to stay in touch and I really appreciate that you, have thought of me this way and would love to speak in the future. I appreciate that you appreciate James. He's just incredibly talented and relatively unknown, and that's just something that I've been trying to correct for the last 3 or 4 years. But yeah, you know, just love to have conversations with interesting people like you, like-minded people. They're hard to find, and a candid conversation is hard to find too, so I appreciate it.
Well, it was an honor, again, to have you on the show, and this is our inaugural broadcast. This is Return to Werewolf, the new show, and it was great having you on. Thank you again. We're going to close up shop now. You have a good evening, Lynn.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.